If money affects your life in any way, Money Making Sense will talk about it. Be financially healthy, wealthy, and wise. Here's your host, Heather Kelly.
Welcome to Money Making Sense, the show that talks about all things money. Today, we're talking about your educational buck. How much can you buy with your money for education? Joining me today is Brandon Wright. He's the editorial director of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Welcome to the show, Brandon.
Hey, thanks, Heather.
I know that the U.S. on average spends about $14,000 per student, and that comes out to $700 billion a year. But where is all this money going? Because I don't see kids walking around with, you know, wad full of money in their pocket.
When we say that they spend that much per kid, obviously this sort of means if you divide their budgets by the number of kids, that's how much it comes out to. The large majority of it goes to staffing, but there are, of course, a bunch of different sort of general line items. The point of the book, though, right, is that, first of all, that this amount is, on average, a lot compared to sort of countries we consider to be peers or our competitors. But oddly, when conversations about school budgets are happening, the sort of overwhelmingly dominant demand is that we need more. And of course that is true in many school systems across the country. Some are underfunded by a lot. But an equally important question, if not a more important question, one that isn't generally asked or talked about, is with the dollars that you have now or any dollars you get in the future, how is it being spent? Can it be spent better? Can it be spent more effectively, more efficiently in terms of improving the academic outcomes of our kids? So that's a problem, and that's why we wrote this book, to try to get that conversation happening in more places and to make sure that the outcomes of those conversations are good for our kids.
Right, because this $14,000 per student on average, while it is more than all the other countries, we are sitting at like 26th or 27th overall performance of our kids in the world?
Yeah. When you look at international tests, the two big ones are PISA, PISA, TIMSS, TIMSS. For decades now, we've got pretty mediocre performances, especially in math. In math, I would actually say, if you look at our peers and competitors, we're getting bad outcomes. And yeah, so it's kind of puzzling with how much spend, how little we're seemingly getting out of it.
Have we investigated the teaching methods in these other countries, and why couldn't they be instilled in the United States?
I mean, there's a lot of reasons for it, from a sort of instructional, curricular, cultural aspect. A lot of these other countries are far more homogenous, both sort of socioeconomically and sort of racially and ethnically. Schools are sort of built a little bit differently there. The teaching profession in a number of these European countries, for example, is more prestigious than it is here, which I think would be a good thing if we could get teaching to be more prestigious here. So there's a bunch of things going into it. I wrote a book a few years back that actually compared gifted education in the United States to gifted education in something like 9 other countries in Europe, Asia, and Australia. And yeah, it's pretty complicated, but there definitely are ways to sort of do instruction better, to improve the profession here, to pay our best teachers more, things like that. But from a money standpoint, there are also just a bunch of ways that we can spend our dollars more efficiently, take some dollars from here, put it there, and we found in districts and school systems that have done these things that we recommend in the book, that they end up getting better outcomes for even less money.
Before we get into that, how we would shift the money and where that went, when you talk about paying our best teachers more to give the profession a bit more prestige, that's coming out of that $14,000 per year per student that we are already spending, correct?
Yeah. So I'm not saying that we necessarily have to spend more, we just spend it differently. And if you paid our good teachers more, I think it would go somewhat towards making the profession more prestigious, but it would also just reward the teachers who are, you know, producing these better outcomes. I think it would attract more people to the profession if they knew, right, if they go there and they excel, that they're going to be rewarded for that outcome. That's, of course, just, you know, one of the many ways that we recommend sort of changing staffing, which is just one chapter in this book. But I do think that both fair and would improve the profession and our schools.
Well, to me, that would indicate getting rid of tenure, because once you hit tenure, and aside from doing some horrid crime, you pretty much can't get rid of a teacher. So they have no incentive to be better teachers and have better outcomes with their students.
Well, I suppose you would have an incentive if you got paid more for it.
Well, okay, so you hit tenure, but if you don't do well, you still don't get a raise? Is that what you're saying?
From the minutia of it would depend on, right, the laws in the area, how schools are set up there, and I think there are a number of issues with the way tenure is set up in our schools, so I'm not debating you on that point. I'm just saying that if you get tenure and your job is protected, I think if you had the potential to make more if your students did better, then that would be a pretty classic incentive to do more. At my job, I don't think I'm going to lose my job if I don't do a lot, but I'm going to get a raise if I do more, so I'm incentivized to do more.
Yes, this is a good place to take a break. When we come back, I want to go into how we would shift our money from where it is now into other areas to how to get better outcomes for our students. And we'll be right back with Brandon Wright. He is a co-editor of Getting the Most Bang for the Educational Budget.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Money Making Sense, the show that if it affects your life in any way, we're talking about it. And today we're talking about how spending money affects education for your kids. Joining me today is Brandon Wright. He is the editorial director of Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Brandon, in that last segment, we gave a little bit of a preface about how much money is spent on each child on average throughout the United States. And even though we are spending the most of any country, pretty much, we are not doing well as far as results on test results for our kids. So you have written a book where you talk about how changing where our money goes can affect the outcome of testing for our kids. First of all, I guess, do we know specifically where money is going right now and versus where it should be going?
Yeah, so a huge percentage of the money is going to staffing, which includes a number of people on staff who are getting paid, but it also includes the cost of employing those people. And I put it that way because one of the biggest sort of cost-sucking elements of school budgets at the moment are benefits for retirees. When you look at pensions and healthcare, especially for people who are no longer in the classroom, combine all 50 states, something like $500 billion in unfunded pension debt. And when schools are spending cash on this, only 30 cents of every dollar spent on this debt is actually going to teachers who are currently in the classroom or will be in the future.
In that earlier segment, we said that $14,000 per student is spent every year in the U.S., but that totals $700 billion a year. And you just said $500 billion of this is actually going to retired teachers?
No. There's just that much unfunded debt. They're not paying that debt every year. They're not paying off the debt like in 2020. They're putting little bits toward it. The issue is that because the debt is unfunded when it wasn't supposed to be, right? The way pension funds are supposed to be set up is you invest this cash is there, and then when somebody retires, they're pulling from the cash that was put in and invested around the time that they got employed so that you aren't essentially robbing Peter to pay Paul. unfortunately, states have not actually lived up to the end of their bargain in terms of maintaining pension funds. So what you're doing now is when teachers come in, part of their sort of cost of being employed is the school system's payments towards this debt. So I'm a new teacher, right? Say it costs $100,000 to employ me. A significant percentage of that is actually going towards benefits, but it's not actually going towards my retirement. If you take $5,000 out of my essential income, you aren't putting that in a fund for me later. You're taking that and you're paying retirees who are already out of the classroom because they didn't actually fund this pension debt. So there's just this huge amount of unfunded debt that is owed to future and current retirees. And that is incredibly expensive. And that is why when I say that when a school system spends a dollar on this debt, only 30 cents of it is actually going to current employees. 70 cents of every dollar is going to people who are outside of the classroom. The problem and the bottom line here is that it's an unsustainable system. Yet states are still signing people up for pensions and for lifetime health care and these things that are great for the teachers, and I'd be happy if they could do it and afford it, but these systems cannot afford to continue doing this, and the people that suffer the most are our students.
So the $14,000 per year that we're spending on students right now, how would you shift that money?
Well, if we're talking about, right, like pensions and healthcare, you would simply, over time, stop spending so much on pensions and healthcare by doing things like signing new employees up for alternative retirement systems like a 401k or a 403b. You would have them pick among different healthcare plans that cost them different amounts of cash so that you're bringing teachers in to play a role in controlling costs, because the cost actually affects them personally also. From a staffing standpoint, we talked about this earlier, we're somewhat stuck on this idea of one teacher, one classroom. We pay a teacher, they instruct a classroom of kids, that's basically all they do. They might write like coaching and extracurricular activities, things around the school, and then we're employing people to do things like professional development for them, to observe their classroom, to hold them accountable, to do all of these different things that we found, actually, that districts can actually use just teams of teachers for. So basically, instead of this one classroom, one teacher approach, these districts have done a team teaching approach where you take your best teachers, the ones that produce the most academic gains, the best student outcomes, you pull them out of the classroom part of the time, and you essentially have them oversee and coach and instruct and help a team of teachers who are not at that level yet. And what you find is you can pay these sort of team leaders more because they're doing more, but you also drastically reduce the cost of things like professional development, oversight of accountability systems, because you don't have to employ all of these extra people to do these jobs in a way that they're not actually doing them very well at the moment. You're just taking teachers you already have. And they found that when they do this well, not only does it cost less, but it produces better outcomes. It makes these teachers better. And we know in education policy that the biggest variable in terms of how much a kid will learn is their teacher.
I totally understand how having a teacher that's already a good teacher help other teachers coming up in the profession. But if you pull them out of their classes part-time, then what happens to the kids? Like, who's teaching the kids when the good teacher is out of the classroom?
What you actually find is when you do it this way, when you get teachers better and when you sort of have this team approach, that you can take these kids and you can sort of spread them out a little bit to different classrooms. But you also have the ability, because you're paying less staff, you have the ability to hire some more teachers. So you aren't really significantly increasing class sizes. And because these good teachers are having an effect on so many other kids, to be clear, this is you get away from the one teacher, one classroom approach. When you have this team teaching approach, all of these teachers improve each other. So the things that each of these teachers are good at, especially the sort of head of the team, instead of affecting just their 30 kids, now they're affecting 90 kids, 120 kids, 150 kids. They are improving the team more kids than they otherwise would have.
That's a good place to take a break then. When we come back, we are still going to be speaking with Brandon Wright. He's the co-editor of Getting the Most Bang for the Educational Buck. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Making Sense, the show that talks about all things money. Today, we're talking about how much money gets you a good education in a roundabout sort of way. Joining me today is Brandon Wright. He is the editorial director of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Brandon, when we came out of that last segment, we were talking how this new model of not having one teacher in one classroom all day long kind of move them around. But how do you know that this approach actually works to get better educated students?
So the specific school that the authors talk about in the chapter is one charter school in Brooklyn, but that's not the only example or the only proof that they actually have. This sort of team teaching approach, the authors have their own system for this. They're Brian and Emily Hassel, the husband and wife run Public Impact, a very well-respected education firm, and they have a instructional system that is called Opportunity Culture, and over 200 schools already use it, and over 100 are committed to using it in the future. It's a system that reaches over 67,000 students and has been for years. So it's a very proven system. A lot of teachers are bought into it, school systems, and over time, it has produced $6 million more dollars for teacher pay, not by adding actually to school budgets, but by basically just moving the dollars around like we've been talking about. And because, again, the biggest variable in how much a kid learns in a given classroom is their teacher, it's a very, very, very big impact.
Mostly what we've talked about is teacher pay, and you're saying that teachers can get paid more if we go to team teaching. But in a lot of our schools across the country, while the average nationwide is $14,000 per student that me, myself, I'm paying to get my kids educated, that doesn't mean every single child actually benefits from the $14,000. I mean, we have school districts here where the students are $18,000 or $20,000 per year, and you have others that maybe get $6,000 benefit per year of spending. If we all go to this team teaching thing and we're able to save more money to help pay teachers, how will that also help individual school districts that are in financial straits?
Well, yeah, sure. And variables that go into, for example, an urban school district paying something like, you know, $25,000 per kid versus a suburban school paying $8,000, it's not necessarily that the urban school is well-funded and the suburban school is underfunded. It's actually generally the opposite. It's because urban school districts end up costing a lot more to run. One reason why, for example, is the high cost of special ed. Washington, D.C., which is where my organization is based and where I used to live, they probably spend the most per student in the entire country. And one of the big reasons is there's a federal law that says that each school district has to fully accommodate the special needs of every child. And there's a lot of kids with behavioral and emotional and physical needs. And especially the behavioral and the emotional needs, those increase in cities because of the many disadvantages of things like poverty. And often it's very costly to accommodate these things, which they must under federal law. So sometimes schools can't even accommodate them. They literally have to pay for these kids to go to private schools that have the means and the resources to actually do that. So that's just one example, but it can drastically raise the sort of per pupil cost for kids in a given area. But when it comes to just getting the benefit out of this, you know, one possible way of reorganizing teachers and teacher pay, you can do this everywhere. And no matter how much you're already spending, you can continue to spend that amount, but you are just pushing the money a little bit more towards teachers' pockets, which, in my opinion, has a variety of benefits. It rewards the teachers for the good job that they're doing. It potentially attracts more teachers to the profession who know that, hey, if I do a really good job here, you know, I'm going to be rewarded for that. And the teen teaching, most importantly, beyond the actual cost thing, is not raising the cost of educating these kids, but it improves the instructional practices of more teachers, which means that kids learn more in more classrooms.
I like that. I think that's a good way to go. One question, though, is when you were describing how this system works, where you have the good teachers pulled out of the classroom and help teach other teachers a good way to instruct their kids, that gets rid of the people that are already hired to go in and monitor their classrooms. So I can hear an argument already with people are going to lose jobs if we go to teen teaching.
I completely agree that that's a messy side of sort of any approach to trying to make money work more efficiently. I sympathize with that. Perhaps there's other things for them to do, but one of the bigger problems, one of the sort of bigger overarching problems in public schooling in general, or really sort of any large sort of public or governmental apparatus, is that it tends to fall victim to basically bureaucratic bloat, where it's very, very easy to add things onto and very hard to take it away. And because there just isn't more money to go around, right, like it's not taxing people more as popular, in fact, it's wildly unpopular. If we only have so much money to go around and we're trying to figure out what's most important, and if we decide one of the most important things is improving the academic outcomes of our kids because of what that does for our communities and states and our country as they age and become adults and they go into the workforce and they participate in their communities and all the important ways that they must do, if that's really important, we have to find a way to do that better, and if spending more isn't an option, and in the pandemic right now, it's less of an option than it has been in a very long time, and it's going to be that way for years to come. If we want to do that, and that's important, then there are going to be trade-offs. And that doesn't make me happy, right? That's not a fun thing. That's not a good thing. But if some system isn't working, just continuing it because you're afraid to deal with the negative trade-offs, but failing to do that is actually continuing to harm our children, that's not a very good approach.
In wrapping up, what is it that our school districts need to do, or our legislators? I mean, how does changing a school district to teen teaching happen? I mean, I personally can't just walk in to the Jordan School District and go, hey, teen teaching, this is how you got to go. And they go, of course, I'm all for it. And they do it.
No, so all of these things are, you know, very complicated to actually change, right? We're just talking about one part, one chapter in a 9-chapter book. But what I'm going to say applies to sort of every one of these policies and education policy in general. For anything to work, right, you need to actually do the community work to get the awareness there, to get the buy-in. And then once you do get the buy-in through things like school leaders, through school boards, through parents, things like that, and then eventually the people who are actually doing this work, the principals in schools, the teachers themselves, you have to find a way to implement it and implement it well and implement it consistently over time. So it's not some like quick thing. It's not like, you know, I'm selling my car and buying a new one this afternoon, right? It's a long process and it's an involved process. And all of these potential policies are, but they're worthwhile. And people who, you know, make policies in schools and try to change those policies, they're aware of this very involved, drawn out sort of way of pushing policies. And they just really have to do the work on an individual level. But what will help is that there are already these big, proof points. I talked about that the authors have, you know, their opportunity culture system that's already benefiting almost 70,000 kids, there's this proof point that makes it easier if you're a policymaker in these areas. You can point to this and be like, look, here's a model. It's working. It's doing this. The school system is like ours. Here's how they've done it. And so that makes it a lot easier.
So if people want to learn more about this system of team teaching, they can get the book. It's called Getting the Most Bang for the Educational Buck. And where can people find that?
You can find it anywhere you buy books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can also find it on my organization's website, which is FordhamInstitute.org.
All right. Thank you, Brandon Wright. Again, you helped edit that book, Getting the Most Bang for the Educational Buck, but you're also the editorial director of Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for listening. You can email me with any questions or topics you want to hear about at hkelly@ksl.com. That's hkelly@ksl.com. And because this is Money Making Sense, you can subscribe for free on Spotify, Overcast, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you listen to your favorite podcast, and you'll never miss another episode.
Thanks for being a Money Making Sense listener. Follow your common sense on the social media, Money Making Sense, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Smartin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.